On arms to you. Om Jesus. Om Babaji. Om Larhe Mahachai. Om Sri Yukteswarji. Om Master. Om Mother. Om Papa Swamiji Mataji. Saints and sages of all religions, we bow to all of you. Free our lives from all obstacles. Give us physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make our minds thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king, reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Om. Amen. Reading from posting this morning, Liberating Surrender. Picture of Peter, waist high in the waters, looking up at Jesus. And of course, the story is that as the boat is in trouble and out on rough seas, suddenly they see their master walking upon the water. Wouldn't that be an amazing thing? And then he does something even more amazing. He calls any of them to come out with him, particularly Peter. And Peter, who is the rock, he is the insight, the spiritual insight, who is first to proclaim that Jesus is the Christed One. Inwardly, Peter is that rock of spiritual perception that recognizes the Christ inside. And so Peter steps out onto the waters, and he's fine until he looks down at the waters and he sees that they're choppy. I'm sure he thinks about how deep the water is there and what in the world is he doing standing out on it. And suddenly he starts to sink. And as he sinks, his mind begins to swirl. He begins to panic. And then suddenly he remembers that Jesus is standing there on the water next to him, and he looks up at him, and he looks into his eyes. Lord, save me. And he's magnetically drawn into the Master's eyes. He feels the power of God surging in him. And suddenly he starts to rise out of the waters of doubt. He feels himself being lifted up into the presence of Christ. And if we can remember this, whenever we are in trouble, let our default always be, let our habit be, that whenever we face obstacles or difficulties of any kind, let us turn to the Christ, let us turn to God within, that holy light. Let us make our reliance upon Him alone. And in this way, when we get into real trouble, that will be where our minds will automatically go. So the reading begins, surrender is the key to finding God realization. We hear the words, we receive the teachings, yet life hits us where it hurts, and we find ourselves caught in a web of conflicting reactions. Love and hate, attraction and repulsion, like and dislike, plans made and plans frustrated. We think we are prepared to surrender, but oh no, not that. On top of life seeming to go after the very things we want to protect, there is also the complication of knowing exactly what surrender means. In modern vocabulary, surrender oftentimes means giving in, throwing in the towel, giving up in defeat. When we look at the lives of great spiritual masters and saints, we see that this is obviously not what is meant. For these unstoppable personalities fight remarkable battles on the human front, persevering when the world stands against them, giving their lives in ceaseless activity and in some cases, literally. There is no hint of becoming flaccid when it comes to standing up for truth virtue, and God. This surrender is not giving in to the world, the body, or desire nature. Rather, it is total abandonment to God's will. Anyone who has lived much of a life can look back and see many lifetimes within this one life, various stages where life takes radical changes and turns us completely new directions from the way we had been going. This can be particularly true if one surrendered to the will of God. While there is no template that God-realized souls follow, many times each one found their lives following a very different course than their assumed natural trajectory. Lahiri Mahashai met Babaji, and the great master was directed back into family life and career when all he wanted to do was stay with his beloved guru. Baba Ram Das was married with a young daughter, and his direction from God took him into a wandering sannyasa life without any support but God alone. But these great masters had to completely surrender all their ideas of what they thought they wanted or should do to the will of God's direction. I look back over my life and I see how many times that if I had listened better, surrendered completely at the time, how much suffering and misdirection I would have been saved. On the other hand, I also look at when beyond everything I wanted or thought I should do, I surrendered heart, mind, and soul to God and gurus, and how I and others were ultimately benefited. There have been times when what God directed was not met with approval by those around me, and these have been most difficult for me. Other points of surrender are when my life took turns that were surprising and unwanted. I did not surrender to illness, lack of prosperity, frustrated attempts to meet goals, or the myriad other problems life presented. But I did surrender to the fact that it was God who was orchestrating these events, to seeing His hand in it all. And I surrendered to His direction in how I must respond to them. When God directed me to leave my profession, which after many years of work had put me in a desirable position, and to throw my lot in with Him without any notion of how that would be, I did not hesitate to make the jump. When He directed me to take a year in silence and solitude, and I simply knew it was His direction, I set about doing this task, though I had never in my life spent even a single day with the object of keeping mum. In these recent years, He has directed me in this rather nomadic life, beyond my expectations of what I should be doing. I have followed Him implicitly, knowing that His will is automatically for the highest good of all. I know His hand has been guiding force in these large trends of my life. Then there is day-to-day life, so many micro-moments that are times of surrender. When the body has aches and pains and does not behave the way it should. When frustrations come up in the day, things do not go as planned, and God prompts me to do one thing when my mind thinks it should be doing something else. All of these are pinpoints of surrender. By themselves, none are absolutely life-changing. However, when taken as a pattern of surrender to God, these micro-moments most definitely make or break a spiritual life. Any one of these day-to-day moments may trigger fear, resentment, anger, desire nature. Any one of them can veer me off track from my sadhana spiritual practice. Spiritual life is surrender in both the big events and the little, one strengthening the other. Some master the big decisions, but fail in the micro moments. Others do well, do it day to day, but get tripped up by a radical change God directs. It must be all, big, little, and everything in between. And when you are surrendered, you experience an alignment with God that transcends the events of this world. It gives you direction that is true and leads you to liberation. You know when to act, when to fight for what is true, and when to observe events unfolding. In this alignment, you experience peace, an inner assurance that God is guiding you in the myriad events of your life. You know there are no accidents in life. All situations are helping to liberate you from the tyranny of attachments. Enacting a life of surrender to God inevitably leads you to complete union with Him, your eternal Savior and liberator from ignorance, and you discover the truth of who and what you truly are. And even though presumably I wrote that, I completely agree with every word. It is wonderful when God speaks through you. I think we have all had that experience. Perhaps we're talking to somebody we've just met, or we're in some situation, and we feel that upliftment. We feel God speaking through us. And there is such bliss, such joy, such inner assurance that comes with this outward expression of the inner spirit. The truth is, the more we grow inside, the more that God can use us and use us as His perfect instrument. And we feel Him. We feel Him moving through us, speaking through us, thinking through us. It is His life force that allows this body to move. Everything. And when we are so engrossed in Him and in His presence and His action through us, then this outer world does not entirely lose meaning, but it begins to become a background to the omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence of God acting and speaking and thinking directly through us. This is the most fantastic life you can possibly imagine. It is what we are working and striving for, and it is the benchmark by which we might measure our spiritual progress to the degree that we live and experience and feel and are totally captivated by the divine presence within us and all around us. I'd like to read from Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. And this is the spiritual battlefield of man's body and mind. The battlefield of these contending forces is Kurukshetra. Kuru, from the Sanskrit word kri, means to work. It's the same as our kriya, isn't it? It means to do action, to work. It is the material action. And kshetra is the field. This field of action is the human body with its physical, mental, and soul faculties, the field on which all activities of one's life take place. It is referred to in this Gita stanza as Dharmakshetra. Dharma, i.e. righteousness, virtue, holiness, thus the holy plane or field. For on this field, the righteous battle is waged between the virtues of the soul's discriminative intelligence, that is, the sons of Pandu, those are the five sons of Pandu, and the ignoble, uncontrolled activities of the blind mind, the Kurus, or the offspring of the blind king, King Dhrishtarashtra. So we find on this battlefield that there are seven armies of the Pandus that are lined up, and these represent the seven different chakras that are inside the spine and in the brain. And then on the other side, there are the ten armies of the Kurus, and the ten represents the sense mind. You have the object of the senses, which are the things that are on the outside. Those are sounds that come to you, light that comes for your vision, and so on, that touches all the five senses. And those are the objects of the senses. Then there are the perceptors that are the senses. So you have your nerves that are in your skin through which you can feel. There are sensors in your tongue by which you can taste, in your nose that you can smell, and so on. So these are the sensors. Those are the five. And then there are the receptor of the senses. Those are the things in the brain that allow you to perceive and interpret those things that you are taking in through the senses. The five receivers in the body and the five translators in the brain make up the 10 qualities of the sense mind. And this is what most people live in most of their lives, most of their days. They wake up in the morning, they open their eyes, they perhaps feel the sheet or the blankets or the bed underneath them. They see their room that they have woken up in. They hear any sounds, if there are perhaps any birds that are in their morning song, or just the quiet of the night, if that is when you wake up, and so on. And so it is that these things begin our day. And then we get up and we feel this body. We have these tactile senses, both internal and external, to stimuli. And so we feel whether our bones are achy that day or whether they are moving smoothly. We go about our day, and everything consumes the mind that is coming in through the senses. What we don't realize, what we don't know, is that there are ways of perceiving true experience that go beyond these five senses and the qualities in the mind that are interpreting and interacting with them. Rather, we form an ego, and that ego mind begins to take on a life of its own. Now, it's thrown into the water in order to learn how to swim, so to speak. We are born into this body, and suddenly the doctor may pick us up by our heels and give us a slap on the back. That's a fine introduction into this world. And the abuse just keeps going from there. We are assaulted by light where before we had been in our mother's womb. And if our mother is healthy and doing the right things, we may have had a fairly comfortable time of it there. And so we enter into this world, but there's a lot of bumps that goes along. There are bruises that happen to this body. There is the ache of hunger. There is cold. There are all these things that assault the senses. And so we're thrown into this kind of survival mode. Even in the best of circumstances, we're still in all of this kind of thraldom of the senses. And so the ego mind, oftentimes triggered from past lifetimes, kicks into gear. And it begins to think, I really need to learn how to swim in this world to get along, to be able to survive. And it is true, there's a certain amount that we must be able to do in this world. And so we get enthralled with this world. We get involved, whether we like it or not. And this is where like and dislike are equal. In fact, many times dislike is more powerful. Pain is a more powerful motivator than pleasure for many of us and many times of our lives. And so that begins to consume us too. We want to have pleasure and we want to avoid pain. It's a very basic thing, isn't it? And as we get more and more involved with this world, we completely forget the world that we came from before this, whether it's an astral world or a causal world, or we are purely in oneness with God. Now, most people come back from the astral world, which is a more refined place than this world is. And people who are, for instance, bullies as children and mean and cruel, they exist on lower planes in the astral, and they're not allowed into the higher planes. It's just like a worm can't grow wings and fly. It takes a bird to be able to do that. And so the worms of consciousness who are in darkness and prefer darkness, it's all their own will, you see. They prefer the darkness over the light, and so they reside in that. But then we come into this world, and we're all thrown in it together. There are no longer those separations. So there's a lot of bumps and bruises that go along the way. We start to feel ourselves to be very much used and abused. And so we have to fight for our survival, both psychologically and physically. And we're not used to that, perhaps, especially if we've been in the more refined worlds beyond this world. And it can seem unfair, but it's not, you see, because we've come to learn a lesson. We've come to learn to go beyond the things of this world, to see the truth and reality that is above this world. And it is oftentimes the pain of this world that reminds us, I don't want to be in this world. I don't want to be limited to this world. I want to know more. I want to be more. I want to know in truth and reality who and what I truly am. And this sets us on to the spiritual path. Now there are some, a very few, who come into this world and they don't forget who they are spiritually. They come with that full knowledge and full awareness. And oftentimes they're thought to be not normal, which they are not, but they are thought to be mentally, have a mental illness of some sort because they don't respond to this world in the same way most people do. But these are very rare circumstances. For the rest of us, we're thrown into this world, and eventually, if we are very, very fortunate, grace comes into our lives and awakens us to a higher potential, a higher possibility. And with that, we pursue a spiritual path. We seek to become enlightened to not just this material reality, but what exists beyond it. Sometimes it is the question of, why is there suffering? And maybe in particular, why is there my suffering? Or perhaps somebody very close to us leaves this body and we think, why is there death? Why is there illness? Why is there old age? Why do we not seem to be able to find happiness and peace on a permanent level? It seems like if we get things arranged just so, then things are changed. And we're no longer in that perfect state of happiness. It's like a constant reminder. This world will never fulfill you. It'll never give you the peace and the bliss and the lasting happiness that your soul yearns for, legitimately yearns for. Only it will never find it in this world. And the more it seeks it in this world, the less it finds it. The more it thinks that it'll be able to rearrange the puzzle pieces until everything fits together, and then it'll be perfect. That disappointment, when that doesn't happen, will constantly occur until finally we give up on the puzzle pieces. We think, all right, there must be something more, a greater reality. And that is our spiritual search for that greater reality. When we really dedicate ourselves in this way, then we are put on to this Kurukshetra, this battlefield, and these two oppositional forces. On the one side, the Pandus with the seven armies, and they are the positive forces inside of you. In the biblical scriptures, this is the Israelites. They are the chosen people. Now, we can't materialize these forces and say, oh, just these people are chosen. No, it is those people who are awakened to a covenant with God, that they feel that they have this bond with God that is indissoluble, that they are called upon to follow God's inner directions. These are the Israelites inside of you. These are the Pandus inside of you. And they are aligned, the Pandus are aligned with Krishna, and Krishna is this Christ center here. And of course, in the Christian scriptures, it takes on different names at different times. Sometimes it's Moses. Sometimes it takes on other names, David, and so on. And that becomes the higher elevating force that's propelling you up. And then there are the oppositional forces. And they come in various names, but in this Gita, it comes as to Kurus. And the Kurus are 100 in nature. It's 10 times 10. And it's the nature of the mind. And they're all over the place. They're constantly, as they're growing up in the story, they're cousins with the Pandus. And they're constantly trying to kill the Pandus because they're jealous of them. They burn the house down while they're sleeping in it. They do all kinds of things to try to kill them and to dissuade them. And this is a story that is common throughout all the scriptures. Krishna, when he was born, from the very moment, even before he was born, there were attempts to kill him even as he came out of the womb. Even as Jesus came out of the womb, and instantaneously that Herod and his forces tried to kill the child. It's the same story, you see. And it's wonderful when you think about it, because it's not just a few who get saved, but God has sent saviors for all of this world and all parts of the world, so that the same story might be told, so that the same elevation of consciousness. Now, you don't absolutely need the stories in order to get salvation, but they help, you see, because they point the mind in the right direction. And you get started in these stories, and you hear them, and you start to internalize them. See, that's a very great change that happens, is when you just read the stories as history, or as about other people at other times, and you see them as the things that happen right inside of you. This is a huge change to make that transition. And now suddenly we see that the Christ is born inside of us. Krishna is born inside of us. These Pandus are inside of us. The Israelites are inside of us. And so, as the story goes, or depending on the time, the Egyptians or the Palestinians are the oppositional forces, even as the Kurus are. And so, as I say, we should not take these as objectified forces, something out in the world, but they are the very things that are inside of us. And so we read in these scriptures about how all of these things align. So Master is saying here, it is referred to in this Gita stanza as the Dharma Kshetra. Dharma is righteousness, virtue, holiness. And Kshetra is the plain or the field. For on this field, the righteous battle is waged between the virtues of the soul's discriminative intelligence or sons of Pandu and the ignoble, uncontrolled activities of the blind mind, the Kurus, or offspring of the blind king, Dhritarashtra. Dharmakshetra, Kurukshetra, refers also, respectively, to religious and spiritual duties and activities, those of the yogi and meditation. You see how Master takes it here, is that the religious and spiritual duties becomes meditation of the yogi. And when you internalize these forces, they are the ones that crave for meditation. We should so cultivate meditation in our lives, the peace that we feel there, being centered in the presence of God, that we actually crave it, we want it. And when it calls to us, it may be during our typical meditation times, it may be any time during the day. And suddenly we feel that uplifting power. And we go with it if we're allowed to by our worldly duties. They don't always allow for that. I remember so many times that I would be chanting God's name and be thinking about God, and just suddenly this tremendous rush of energy would come up my spine. My eyes would close, even as they are now. My attention would focus at the ajna. And I'd feel that tremendous power in me, and whatever I was doing on the outside would have to take a rest. But as we know, because we live in this world, we have to render to Caesar's what is Caesar's. Sometimes we're not always able to do that, and so I would negotiate with God. And I would say, God, I can't do my work in this world and be with you so intimately in the way that you're calling me right now. If you will let me focus on this world and doing the things that you have called me to do, then I will take time later in the day, and it can be just the two of us together. And you know what? Oftentimes, he would agree with the negotiation. And he would recede. Now, I wouldn't lose his presence totally. It just wasn't as strong. Because when that lifts you up in the spine, and it takes you into the higher regions of the brain, and your eyes closed, you're no longer with this world. You know, sometimes we think of the astral body or the causal body or the spiritual body as being someplace else. But that's really the spiritual, or the material mind, rather, that is thinking of it in that way, because it thinks I can only be in this place or that place. Either I'm in church or I am at work, and the two don't go together. But that's not how God thinks about it. Everything is right with you right now. When you go inside and you feel that tingling life force going throughout your nervous system, that is your astral body. That is your energy body that is flowing to you, that is giving you life and energy in this moment. When you are lifted up and you feel the purified air of God's thoughts, God's mind, you are in the stillness of spirit, then you are in the causal, and it's tremendous. It really is. And God can whisper to you the greatest truths there. Suddenly, through thought transference, you have an understanding. It just unfolds inside of you like a flower opening its petals. And suddenly you know, and you know that you know. This is a tremendous thing. So you don't have to go off to the causal world. The causal world is here, in you, all around you. When you look at a tree, and I've done it many times, and I've seen the vital life force flowing through that tree, through that flower, through that plant, you see the vital life energy in stones that are theoretically inanimate. But it's filled with life energy. You see the air around you, filled with that life energy, dynamic prana, the walls that are around you, everything. Everything is singing with that wonderful music of the spheres. And you see it's all here. It's all around you. And you have nowhere to go and nothing to do in that sense. So this is the transference of your consciousness, and you may be aware, almost like you're aware of an outline of the body, and you may have some awareness of the body, or you may have none at all, but you're vitally aware of the life energy that is flowing into you, or of this wonderful causal realm of wonderful God thought inside of you. Or you even go beyond all thought and all life energy, and you just simply are. Your being is expansive. It seems to go on forever. It is filled with light and inner stillness. And this is God within you, God the Father, beyond all creation. And then your consciousness starts to come down. Now, when we do this in the beginning, we lose God consciousness as we come back down into this body. But as you refine and purify yourself, you maintain that consciousness. There's no loss of it. Now, you don't have the intensity of the moment in the same way. You open your eyes and you start to see this world, but you don't just see this world in an ordinary way. You see it filled with a spiritual presence. And you look out around you, and you carry that presence with you as you move, as you think, as you have your being. This is really experiencing God. Whether your eyes are closed or open, whether your mind is withdrawn, or whether it is operating in and through these senses, still God is. God is. And as you purify the mind, even if things are difficult, if you have pain in this body, if you have difficulties that confront you, It doesn't make you lose that connection with God. Now this comes through the purification of this mind and body. This comes through entering on to the battlefield of Kurukshetra. It comes from being on the cross as these uplifting forces collide with the horizontal forces of this world in its ascendancy going up the spine and the brain and into the total oneness with God. You know, Jesus, even after he was through that initial crucifixion, said, "Touch me not, I have not yet ascended to my Father." Because he had just gone through the first experience at that point. And then you go through all three bodies and you are released, but you still have not ascended. There's more work to do. And in that total ascension, you are still tempted along the way. That's why he said, "Touch me not." Because he is speaking to Mary. Mary represents the uplifted senses. Now, uplifted senses becomes bliss. All the life energy that before had gone through all of your nervous system suddenly gets centered in the spine. And it is blissful then. That is why Mary Magdalene is such a powerful actor in these scriptures. She is the first one to meet the Christ after his resurrection out of the tomb. It is because she is feeling the bliss of God. And she is recognizing that the Christ is not dead, but is living. And she reports it to all the different disciples. And the disciples are those powers that lie along the spine. And so she is that uplifting divine bliss that's in the spine. And she's reporting to all of the different parts along the spine, all these powers. And they are awakened then. That the Christ is not dead but living after this tremendous experience. Now it comes gradually most times. This awakening, this uplifting, this transformation that's going on. And so even then you face some tests along the way. Your old life can call to you. Because, as Mother described, you're like John on the Isle of Patmos. You're not what you were. And you are not what you are yet to become. And when you're in this in-between state, sometimes your mind wants to reach back to your past. Oh, life was more comfortable, more known in my old life. And so it may be a temptation to come and try to recreate that. And that attachment reaches out to this world. And if you go with it, you can lose the experience. It seems a strange thing. You can go through so many experiences in God. And through your choices, as you ascend up into your Heavenly Father, you can bring your consciousness back into this world. And you can start living an ordinary existence. And you think, how in the world could I ever go back to that? Having experienced this uplifting power and grace. And yet it happens. Sometimes people just don't come back into this material senses, but they reside in the astral, and they carry on a warfare there because they are attached to it. They don't want to go beyond because they've encountered something that has given them pause, and instead of marching and flying to the goal, they get diverted because it seems a more comfortable, a more known realm, and sometimes they can get pulled into these astral battles. I talked earlier about having these astral battles that were going on in and around me, and how this firebrand was burned into my neck and even created blistering and marks there that have healed now. But this is true. This is true. And some people get pulled into this world. You see that with people who are dedicated towards gaining powers and different occult faculties. And they'll be pulled into that. And it can be a never-ending story. It really can be. We can just go with it as long as we want to, as long as it holds a fascination. And particularly, when it holds a safety beyond that which we have encountered and are afraid to go through. But when we have the courage and the tenacity and the focal point of mind to go beyond all of these different temptations along the way, God will guide us. God will protect us. God will take us through whatever experience is necessary. That is where total and complete surrender is required. It can't be partial. It can't be just at our convenience. It can't be just to our liking. It has to be the whole way. And when it talks about the death of the ego and the death of the body, it is not that this body necessarily dies completely in an outward sense. But inwardly, we have to feel we are ready to do that. We are ready to go past everything in this world and to learn how to trust so completely, so perfectly in God that this world has no sway, no call upon us whatsoever. And you may be thinking to yourself, how could I ever do all of that? And yet, that is the ego who thinks that. Because it is not you. When you surrender to God, a new power comes into you, a new consciousness, a new intelligence. It guides you, it directs you, it empowers you to overcome everything that you encounter in this world and in this life. But what it requires is turning away from the things of this world, not being consumed by the different difficulties that come up to you. But as soon as a difficulty comes, you instantly turn your mind to God. This is a great habit to develop. You know, so many of us, if everything is just feeling peaceful and wonderful, and we're aligned with God, it's just perfect, just perfect. And then something comes along. We're driving along the road and somebody cuts us off. We're trying to accomplish something and we get into a frustration. And you can just feel the veil of separation come over you. The veil of ignorance that you are now separate from God. How dare this person cut me off in the road? Why isn't this project going more easily? And we get angry. We get frustrated. We become fearful. And this seals the deal. This makes this encapsulation and separation from God complete in that moment. To develop the habit that instead of turning away from God and becoming entirely focused on this world when difficulties come, we do just the opposite. We turn away from the difficulty. It's still there. It's still something for us to accomplish, to do, to overcome. But our mind goes to our greatest resource. And that resource is God. God, we're in quite a pickle here. What are we going to do? How are we going to solve this problem? You make God your senior partner. And you turn to Him. You think of Him. You open yourself to Him. Now you practice doing this mentally, even when you're not having a difficulty. If you think something's coming up, you're going for a job interview, you feel nervous about it, and you think, God, that's us, both of us in this interview. You're going to speak through me. You're going to do these things through me. And you turn your mind over to God and you feel Him speaking through you. His mind, His thoughts in you. You feel an inner calm come to you. Now God is more powerful than this world. Isn't that a wonderful thing? To really start to do this. And so you practice this with everything that you have to do. Putting God first. Putting Him on the throne of your own consciousness. That He is the king, she is the queen that is reigning in your kingdom. And that this world is not the most powerful. It is not the thing that captures your own mind. So Master speaking here again. Dharmakshetra, Kurukshetra refers also respectively to religious and spiritual duties, those of the yogi and meditation, as contrasted with mundane responsibilities and activities. Thus, in the deeper metaphysical interpretation, Dharmakshetra, Kurukshetra signifies the inner bodily field on which the spiritual action of yoga meditation takes place for the attainment of self-realization. The plane of the cerebral spinal axis and the seven subtle centers of life and divine consciousness. So you see how beautifully Master lays it out. How perfectly Lari Mahasaya had commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita going along these lines perfectly. And he related many of the things that happen in the body, even as Mother talked about with the Christian scriptures. Sri Yukteswar had his commentary on these scriptures. And Master gave a strong psychological interpretation to these scriptures. You see, whether it is of the body, relating to the body, relating to the mind, relating to pure spiritual consciousness, it all has value because we operate on all those levels. Different masters come with different ideals in mind. And this is not because one is wrong and the other are right, or one is right and all the others are wrong. It is because that one has come with a special mission to bring forward some great truth of God. Mother came to talk about the Christian scriptures and the inner meaning of those scriptures that have remained hidden for nearly 2,000 years. Master came to bring about a revolution, the merging of East and West, that both have the truth, both have the secret of life. Papa Ram Dass came to bring the power of the name. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. The power of surrender. You see, everyone comes with their own special emphasis. But it doesn't mean that they don't have the whole thing. So for us, as sadhakas, as spiritual practitioners, we take these truths that are taught to us. And unless we put them into work, they are like those proverbial tools that just get set onto the shelf and never used. They might look pretty, but they don't do anything that's useful. I'm all about utilitarian and meeting the needs of devotees exactly where they're at. We live in this world. We live, by and large, for many of us, in a state of ignorance. Sometimes a bit more is of God and a bit more is of this world in our minds. But there's a balance. These two forces actively work. And to take these tools and really put them to work, learn to make your mind attuned to God, to feel the peace, His peace. Master would say he would meditate until he had made God contact during his meditation. You see, then we're not just going according to, all right, I have my half an hour, 45 minutes, or hour in, and that's it, I fulfilled my duty. We haven't really fulfilled the function of meditation until we make that God contact. Until we learn to love God more than this world. How can we love God unless we know God? You know, that's really an interesting idea. You really have to know God to really love Him. To really feel that attraction to Him. To feel pulled towards Him. To feel that bliss, to feel that peace, to feel that love, that light. that is what gives you the great power of attraction, to go all the way to God. Yes, we must practice discrimination. Not this, not that. Those things to avoid. And then to put our mind on God. And then to go into meditation and feel that peace, feel that bliss. I remember so powerfully that first morning after I had gotten Kriya from Mother. This is back in 1974. And I sat outside and I had a wool blanket that I put underneath myself. And it was a beautiful sunny morning. And the sun was coming up and shining in my face. And I felt, after Kriya effect, so peaceful, so much light, so much love, so much peace, everything. And I thought, my goodness, life could end right here, and I'd be perfectly happy, perfectly happy. But that, of course, was not the end of my journey. That was just merely the beginning of this journey. So we must persevere. We must remember what it is that we are about in our life. Not to get sidetracked with too many things of this life. That type of surrender will take you all the way to God. All the way to God. Isn't that a wonderful thing? There's a little story here by Ramakrishna. And he says, a man must have some kind of faith before he undertakes a work. Further, he feels joy when he thinks of it. Only then does he set about performing the work. Suppose a jar of gold coins is hidden underground. First of all, a man must have faith that the jar of gold is in there. He feels joy at the thought of the jar. Then he begins to dig. As he removes the earth, he hears a metallic sound. That joy increases. Next, he sees the corner of the jar. This gives him even more joy. Thus, his joy is ever on the increase. Standing on the porch of the Kali temple, I have watched ascetics preparing their smoke of hemp. I have seen their faces beaming with joy and anticipation of the smoke. Just imagine. To have that great of a desire, that great of anticipation of joy, to meditate, to chant God's name. I've spoken before about the man who was at the ashram that was up by Babaji's cave, and how he had worked all day long, doing sweeping and different chores about the ashram. And I think the time was 5 o'clock, but anyway, his work day was over. And he literally ran from where he was, where he had dropped his work, and he ran to the bhajan hall to get to the harmonium and to start to sing and to chant towards God. And I thought how wonderful it would be to feel that way about going to God, about our meditation time, about our time with Him alone, that we would run from where we are. Isn't that a wonderful thing? A wonderful thing. This is the way that we feel when we love God. And we love God more than this world. There is no place we would rather be. There is nothing that we would rather be doing. It is in that spirit. It is in that joy. It is in that love. That I pronoun to you, that my greatest wish, my greatest prayer, is that you should feel that kind of an attraction for God, that you should desire to be His and His alone, and that He should live His life through you, that you should have the joy of feeling Him, His thoughts thought through you. His life energy moving through your body. His bliss uplifting your being. It's not just for other people, you know. This is our inheritance. It is ours, and it is inviolably ours, no matter what we have done in the past. It does not disqualify us from our inheritance. It may mean that we have to work harder, we have to dig deeper for that jar of coins. But the jar of gold, the gold of the Spirit, is there. Deeply buried as it might be. And the way to go about it is to start to work for Him. Start to work. Start to dig. Reach out for that bliss. Reach out for that love and light. And God will respond. He will respond. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Ram. Victory to God. Victory to the light. God, Christ, Gurus, greatest blessings upon you. And may you swim in that infinite ocean of Spirit.